Come with me as we take a trip around the Andes, from the Nazca Lines to Lake Titicaca. Once again, we're going to follow Graham Hancock's journey in Fingerprints of the Gods. Hello, I'm Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. In this episode, we're going to cover Part 2, Chapters 4 through 12, basically covering the Viracocha myth and a lot of the area around Lake Titicaca. Now, in the first episode, we talked about Graham Hancock's Part 1, and we covered the mystery of the maps, and while I didn't agree with everything he had to say, a lot of it was compelling. Link down below. Now, the second section of Fingerprints is almost three times as long, so let's not waste a lot of time in the intro. Now, while most of you will no doubt be aware of these amazing glyphs that are etched into the desert, I'll go over the basics with you quickly. The Nazca Lines are these gigantic geoglyphs located on the Nazca Plateau, consisting of geometric shapes and animals and some weird humanoid figures, I guess you'd say, scattered all over a couple hundred square miles. Now, drones and AI have allowed many to be found that were invisible until recently, allowing us to get a lot more of a grip on what's going on there than we had when Hancock wrote Fingerprints of the Gods. Which is kind of funny. It's reminiscent of about a century ago when the Nazca Lines were first discovered, thanks to airplanes flying over the region, as the more commonly known glyphs aren't really visible from the ground as anything except for kind of a rut. Made by simply scraping away the topsoil and stones until different colored earth beneath is visible, the tech involved is simple, but there's no question the planning and math that went into these is pretty impressive for the day. Dated by context, using the oldest artifacts found on the site, the lines' constructions are dated to about 1700 to 2300 years ago for the oldest ones. But as Hancock rightly points out, in this case we really can't date very well by context. It could be far older and we have no way of knowing. Many sites are datable by context. I mean, if you dig under a stone and find datable material and that stone's a part of a structure, you can be pretty certain that that datable material is more or less contemporary with construction. But the Nazca Lines aren't that way. I mean, the best we can do is find something and hope that it's contemporary with the construction. That's it. Now, the spider glyph is of particular interest to Hancock, and I can see why. It's very impressive. It's precise for something that the builders couldn't double-check as they were putting it together, and it got Hancock's attention for a couple of things. One is the bent leg, which is something we see on spiders that live far from the area, like many of the animals that are depicted on the sand at Nazca. The species of spider that sports such a leg is called Ricinuliae, I believe you probably pronounce it. Once again, sorry, I'm not the ninja at pronouncing things. The bent leg there, that's where the spider hides his manhood. For some reason, Hancock claims you'd need a microscope to make out the detail that's seen on the glyph on the Nazca Lines, and that's not really true. I mean, as you can see here, the thing's bent leg is, like, visible from across the room, right? But Hancock is right that it is depicting an animal that's not local to the region, but he is wrong saying you'd need a microscope to see that spider's junk. No offense, Mr. Spider. The other thing Hancock mentions about the spider is the archaeoastronomy done at the site. Dr. Phyllis Pitt Luga posited that the spider was a depiction of the constellation Orion and that she believed that it was the different lines were used to track the changing of Orion's declination over the years. Her work isn't available. She gave a lecture at an astronomy conference, but it's not archived, and Hancock's reference is with personal correspondence, so that doesn't do me a whole lot of good. But I can kind of see her data by the challenge that was brought against it by Anthony Avini, who is a pretty famous archaeoastronomer if you're into that sort of thing. He's well-respected anyway. And his challenge speaks a lot to how she put that thing together. Basically, he claims that she failed to utilize all the lines that one would use if you were using this to track the declination of Orion, and that's kind of a big deal when you're putting together an archaeoastronomy hypothesis. If you just like start picking and choosing which lines you do and don't go with, all of a sudden you're out in the weeds, right? Dr. Pitt Luga seems to have held a different position in regards to the other glyphs at Nazca. She claimed that they were depictions of the dark spots in the sky, the areas without any stars, as opposed to constellations. I'm not sure if she changed her position before or after Avini critiqued her work on the spider, or if that even had any bearing in it at all, but it does kind of seem that her position on that being Orion has fallen apart over time, as she herself doesn't seem to have like supported it in her later work on Nazca. Now, there are a lot of other archaeoastronomy hypotheses based around the Nazca lines, but that's really difficult to determine, as so many of the lines were built over the top of other ones, and like I said, you can't just go ignoring things. So without like a confirmed dating sequence, it's really difficult to know what these lines were meant to represent. Now, the area the lines were made in is pretty inhospitable. Very few people have settled there long-term over the ages. Now, the purpose for the lines has been discussed and debated, but really never firmly established. One of the hypotheses that Hancock mentions is the idea that it was a script, that it was a way to communicate words. Now, perhaps words is a little bit of a stretch, but the discovery of all these new glyphs seems to have suggested the idea was originally to convey some sort of message to others. The earlier glyphs were easily visible from the ground and recognizable, and they seemed to depict things that would be the kind of thing you would use as a signal or a symbol to let people know certain ideas or things. Now, of course, the ideas are lost to time, but that seems a pretty valid hypothesis. And then the idea is the concept eventually got spread to sending a message to the gods, which is why you have Nazca lines pointed straight up at the sky that nobody on the earth could see. These were not meant for other humans to see, but it's the same idea. That's a pretty valid hypothesis in my opinion. Also, it makes the Candelabra of Paracas kind of an interesting tidbit there, because it's visible for miles from the shore. So perhaps it was a beacon for guys that were out at sea, letting them know, hey, you're getting back close to home. Here's the way. I mean, that's not really a stretch, except for you have to assume that they had boats that would go out in the ocean and make maps. Now, Hancock likes to make a mystery of the Nazca Lines, and I can't really blame him. It's easy work. You just highlight what we know, and bam, you have a mystery. Now, the new knowledge we have helps a little, but they're still almost as mysterious as it was when Fingerprints was written. Now, as we move on, the fog of history thickens, and it's going to become harder and harder to get a grasp on the ancient sites and structures we're going to talk about. Because next we go to the Viracochas, a race of godlike people who helped the Incas or appeared to the Inca king or something along those lines. It's really difficult to parse, and not only are we dealing with multiple different regions and different accounts, but they're all being filtered through the lens of Spanish historians, and there's a Catholic influence, anti-pagan, pro-Christian ideology that is very palpable in all the accounts that I've read. Now, it's worth noting that when I was a kid in school, I was taught the Viracocha was a bearded god that the Inca mistook for Cortez, which facilitated Cortez's rapid advance through the Inca territory. By being mistaken for gods, the conquistadors easily bypassed many of the defenses and were basically invited right in to hang out with the royals who they betrayed. Now, this is challenged now, and apparently it was challenged back when I learned that stuff in school, but it was challenged in the halls of academia, not in the halls of an elementary school. So, to be very, very clear here, when Hancock says things that seem a little, well...
Not only does Graham repackage this 1882 theory, but he directly cites it in his 1995 book, Fingerprints of the Gods, with this gem of big racist energy. The road system and the sophisticated architecture had been ancient in the time of the Incas, but that both were the work of white auburn-haired men. What the actual fuck?
It should be remembered that this is what public education taught until very recently. So he wasn't going all Johnny Reb here, he was just using the consensus of the day when he wrote the book. Nowadays, thanks to the increases of information sharing and social awareness, it seems quite obvious that certain aspects of the Viracocha myth were incorporated from Christianity, superimposed onto existing Inca beliefs in order to browbeat the population. Viracocha was said to have survived the Great Deluge and to have helped civilize the area around Lake Titicaca. Now, the similarities between the biblical deluge and other old world flood myths, coupled with the bearded man civilizing people aspect, has two major interpretations. Either it's a true account, an eyewitness testimony of bearded men in South America after the flood, or it's an invention of the Spanish used to help manipulate the population. A lot of people also, of course, believe that it's probably a combination of the two, and that's where I tend to lean. Mingling religious ideas is something we've seen Christianity do in order to gain converts, and it's not unthinkable that something could have happened here. It is worth noting that the Incas, their subjects, and their neighbors would use different styles of piercings, headdresses, and other ornamentation to differentiate between groups of people. One tribe would wear their earrings one way, another would wear it differently. In one account, the Incas divided one of their subject tribes into three different tribes and forced them all to wear their same traditional headdress, but they had to dye it a different color based on which one of these tribes that they now existed in. So the idea of a group of people cultivating beards in South America as a way to distinguish this tribe from another isn't unthinkable. As a matter of fact, it would kind of like coincide with what else we know about the peopling of that area. Now, that doesn't diminish the mythological achievements of these Viracochas by any means, but it does undermine the notion that they were white or European or from another continent. Now, in the near future, I'll be making a video on this and going through different myths about Viracocha and evaluating what I, in my opinion, is Spanish influence or original myth. Now, of course, it'll just be my opinion, but I'm going through all of them. As a matter of fact, that's why this video took so long to get out. Originally, I was going to do that as part of the video, but it became there was going to be no time for any fingerprints. It's just that's going to be all Viracocha, man. There's so much to go through there. So if you are interested in that, let me know down below, and I will put that video together and kind of attach it as an addendum to this guy here. And if you're interested in seeing the academic community skepticism, Dr. Miano has a pretty good video on it. I'll link down below. And I don't agree with everything in the video, of course. I mean, it's Dr. Miano. Me and him, it'd be a cold day in hell before we agree on everything. But in this case, he definitely expresses the skepticism the academic community has and does it in a very good way. It's easy to understand. One of the best sources, yet hardest for me to read personally, is the Commentaries of the Incas by Garcilaso de la Vega, published in 1609. De la Vega was the son of a conquistador father and an Incan mother, and the cultural conflict that he was going through is so apparent in his writing, as he attempts to both criticize the pagan ways of the indigenous people while at the same time portraying them as extremely virtuous, kind, and forgiving. Hancock cites him a couple of times, along with many others, and De la Vega's account seems less corrupted by Spanish influences, but they're still noticeable throughout. His personal conflict shows through the centuries of writing, and it makes you shed a tear for a person who died long before I ever lived. Now, his accounts are noteworthy for several reasons. One of them here is that he never refers to Viracocha as white or pale skin, just bearded. Viracocha was represented as a tall, well-built man, wearing a beard as long as your hand. He was dressed in a tunic that came down to his feet, and he was holding on a leash at the end of a chain, a strange animal with paws that looked like a lion's claws. There was something about this statue that reminded one of the likeness of our holy apostles, and especially of his honor Saint Bartholomew, who was always shown with the devil tied to his feet. When the Spaniards discovered this temple and the statue of Viracocha, they said that Saint Bartholomew had perhaps been in Peru to teach the word of God to the Gentiles. And more recently, 30 years ago, the Cusco half-breeds found a brotherhood under the patronage of this saint, the rules of which forbade Spaniards of joining it, with the result of the latter being jealous of the luxury and extravagance and marked festivals of this brotherhood, whispered that it was perhaps less an apostle than the Inca Viracocha that they were revering. His accounts do include the Incas mistaking Cortez for Viracocha. As we have already seen, the name Viracocha was given to the prince after his dream, which everybody considered to be premonitory. He specified that the ghost who had appeared before him wore a thick beard, whereas the Indians are clean-shaven, and that his robe came down to the ground, while that of the Incas came only to their knees. This is why the Peruvian people called the Spaniards Viracochas, the minute they saw them. And this belief in their sacred origin, as soon as they set foot on the land, was only strengthened when the same Spaniards killed Atahualpa, the usurper tyrant who had just seized power unjustly from the legitimate heir to the throne, Huasuar Inca, and put him to death. For, in the simple minds of the Indians, only the same messenger from God could have manifested himself in this way twice in their history to save Cusco and the dynasty, the first time from the Chanchas and the second time from Atahualpa. And an Incan king that took the title of Viracocha after seeing a vision also supposedly predicted the Spanish coming. The Inca Viracocha is also credited with having been the first of the Incas to foresee the coming of the Spaniards. The Indians say that after the events had proven the exactness of his first dream, the Amutas, the high priests and the elders of the Cusco temple, who fulfilled the duties of soothsayers, acquired the habit of questioning the Inca Viracocha regularly about the subject of his dreams. They interpreted them by observing the comets in the sky, in addition to the earthly auguries taken from birds and animals offered up in sacrifice. It was on the occasion of one of these collective consultations that a dream dreamt by the Inca Viracocha warned them that one day unknown bearded men would land in Peru and overthrow both the religion and empire of the Incas. This message was transmitted traditionally by each king to his successor without anything being known to the people, in order that the dignity of the Incas and their supposed supernatural origin should risk no perturbation at the result of this prediction. Now, he claims to have gotten some of his information from family, mostly his mother and great uncle. While he does mention that they said some things, pained them too much to speak of, and that he's sure that there were rituals that they hid from him, much of the information that he got from his family were blood relatives that were alive before the conquistadors arrived. Now, Hancock mentions a stone dropped near Sacsayhuaman in De La Vega's account. Garcilaso also reported something else interesting. In his Royal Commentaries of the Incas, he gave an account of how, in historical times, an Inca king had tried to emulate the achievements of his predecessors who had built Sacsayhuaman. The attempt involved bringing just one immense boulder from several miles away to add to the existing fortifications. This boulder was hauled across the mountain by more than 20,000 Indians going up and down very steep hills. At a certain spot, it fell from their hands over a precipice, crushing more than 3,000 men. In all the histories I surveyed, this was the only report which described the Incas actually building, or trying to build, with huge blocks like those employed at Sacsayhuaman. The report suggests that they possessed almost no experience in the techniques involved and that their attempt had ended in disaster. But De La Vega does have it slightly differently here. Pay attention. Four master architects contributed to the construction of Tin's Fortress, the first and principal one of whom was Hualapa Rimchi Inca, who designed the general plan. He was succeeded by Inca Marchani. However, the principal buildings of Tiwanaku, of which we have already spoken, are attributed to the third one, whose name was Acahuana Ica. The fourth and last architect of the fortress was Calacunchoy, and it was his time that the so-called Weary Stone, to which he gave his name, was hauled there. The dimensions of this stone are incredible, and I should like to be able to give them, but unfortunately I do not possess them. The stone remained on the plateau in front of the fortress, and the Incas say it was so wearied by its long journey that it came to a halt, wept tears of blood, and could go no further. It has remained unhewn in the rough state which it was found. I remember that there was one or two holes in the corner of it, which, according to the Indians, was where the eyes were, which was with it had wept blood. The truth, however, as told by the Amutas, is that this boulder was hauled across the mountain by more than 20,000 Indians going up and down very steep hills, and at a certain point it fell from their hands over a precipice, crushing more than 3,000 men. Thus it was they and other slaves who wept blood, not the stone. It was also the slaves who arrived too weary on the plateau to be able to hoist their burden up upon the fortress. It isn't portrayed as something only their ancestors could do. It was portrayed as most likely the biggest stone they ever tried to move and failed. Now, not only does De La Vega never speak of white men when referring to Viracocha, he refers to a few other things that I believe that Hancock missed that would definitely make his case better for mingling of civilization from Egypt to Lake Titicaca, which is one of the things Hancock definitely tries to hang his hat on in this book. Now, one of these would be the religion of the Incas. Not only do they worship the sun, but the kings of the Incas were said to be reincarnated with the sun, as the sun, much like the pharaohs in Egypt. Also similar to the pharaohs is the tradition of marrying your sister or your brother and keeping the bloodline pure that way, which is something else that you see the pharaohs doing. But possibly the most intriguing thing to me was this little tidbit right here. The fire used for this sacrifice had to be fresh, or as they said, given to them by the hand of the sun. For this, they took a large bracelet, belonging to the high priest, and similar in form to that usually worn on their left wrist by the Incas. The central motif of this bracelet was a very carefully polished concavity as big as half an orange. They turned this towards the sun to capture its rays, which they then concentrated on a small wisp of very dry, fluffy cotton that caught fire instantly. This, then, was the origin of the fresh fire, which, as I said before, served to burn sacrifices offered to the sun. Now, of course, an artifact like that has never been found in the region, and odds are one probably never will be. If it truly did exist, it almost certainly would have been looted during the heyday of the conquistadors. But still, if you want to talk about out-of-place tech, this definitely fits the bill, and Hancock doesn't mention it, so I will. And it certainly is an interesting tidbit as far as I'm concerned. I kind of have a thing for concave mirrors in case you haven't noticed. But if you haven't taken the time to read the world commentaries of the Incas, I highly suggest doing so. It's really informative, but again, you got to take it with a grain of salt and maybe bring a box of tissues. It is pretty sad. Now, as Hancock moves on to the Great Flood, the accounts he cites again seem far more old world than De La Vega's account. De La Vega simply mentions that Viracocha arrived in Tiwanaku after the flood, and other accounts get more biblical, the references to God wiping people out for some unknown sin or something like that. De La Vega's account seems, again, a little bit more reliable, but not necessarily true. And when we get to Tiwanaku, that'll shed a little light on this. But first, Hancock's going to take us to the Inca City in the Clouds, probably the most famous city the Incas ever made, Machu Picchu. He attempts to date the site using archaeoastronomy, founded on the work of the professor of astronomy, Rolf Mueller, done in the 1930s. Now, Mueller dated it to about 6,000 years ago, a date the archaeologists disputed then and really do now that we got carbon dating to weigh in on it. Now, it is understandable to think about scientists trying to find a way to date things back in those days. You had no carbon dating, so there was no set way to do it. So if a building was built aligned to stars and stuff, this offered a way to date something fairly reliably. So I can see why this route was heavily traveled down in those days before carbon dating especially. But Machu Picchu is much more firmly dated now, and it looks to be about 500 years old according to that data. Furthermore, later archaeoastronomy work done on the site has demonstrated it's a lot more complicated than Mueller gave it credit for. The tower that he labeled an observatory and fixated on, it seems to be not just an observatory, but it plays with shadows, much like the temple at Chichen Itza, the pyramid at Chichen Itza, the famous undulating serpent that many of you are already aware of. It does the same kind of thing, as I'll show pictures of here, that other archaeoastronomers have noticed, that this seems to incorporate shadow play, and it is not doing it from 6,000 years ago. It's doing it pretty well right now, actually. Now, there is no question that archaeoastronomy played heavily into the site. I'll link a couple of papers down below, one by Dr. Giulio Magli, and he goes into how it's quite possibly a representation of the Island of the Sun in Lake Titicaca and a artificial pilgrimage site, basically, so that people didn't have to go to the Island of the Sun. They could go to Machu Picchu instead. Anyway, the dating of Machu Picchu by archaeoastronomy, not really that viable, but figuring out what it was used for, archaeoastronomy seems to shine in that regards. When discussing Lake Titicaca itself, Hancock talks about a lot of the more interesting tidbits about it, that the land rose from the sea and still has seahorses and other marine type of animals inside of it, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. But then he uses the claims of Ponansky to support that Tiwanaku used to be a port, even though it's 100 foot above the shore of the lake today. I don't believe it was a port. It seems to me that Tiwanaku was a site that venerated water heavily. It was used there in ways that we don't see elsewhere in the New World. And in fact, a lot of the construction of Tiwanaku is stuff that we don't see anywhere else except that tiny little region there. The entire city used a system of canals, pits, and loose earth to maintain a fairly constant water supply all year round. They had the Tiwanaku fields there, which used water not only to irrigate them, but it collected solar heat and radiated it during the early morning hours, in particular, to keep the frost off of the crops for the first few weeks of the horrid early frosts that killed off their crops. It's pretty smart stuff. And we see water symbolism all over Tiwanaku, so it does make sense that a port, a fake port, would be something that they would build there. Now, Hancock mentions a variant of the Viracocha myth that strongly resembles the Osiris myth. They put his blessed body in a boat of Totora rush and set it adrift on Lake Titicaca. There he sailed away with such speed that those who tried to cruelly kill him were left behind in terror and astonishment, for this lake has no current. The boat came to shore at Cochamarca, which today is the River Desguardo. Indian tradition asserts that the boat struck the land with such force it created the river, which before did not exist. And on the water so released, the holy body was carried many leagues away to the sea coast at Arica. Which is not only interesting, but it also makes the similarities that I mentioned earlier with ancient Egypt a little bit more impressive. This isn't what I would call evidence per se, but it is an interesting correlation. And you get enough of these and it does kind of start to look like evidence. Now the similarities with the reed boats, that's a little bit less fascinating to me. He mentions that you have the same kind of reed boats in the Nile that you have at Lake Titicaca. They're both using reeds. They're both, and you know, not going out to sea with them, but they're on big chunks of water. It's not surprising that they are very similar. I don't necessarily find that a particular correlation, but again, you start making mounds of these kinds of things, and all of a sudden, well, okay, that is one more little drop in the bucket there. Now, Tiwanaku itself is enigmatic compared with the other megalithic sites in South America, like I mentioned. It is one of the sites the Incas claim to have not built, and it really does show signs of being built in a very different manner. The size and well-fitted joints, now that's found all over this part of the world. It's still enigmatic. How you got these giant blocks fitted that well is a little bit on the tricky side. But only at Tiwanaku and nearby regions do we see this advanced use of water, including the storage system. Water storage system that held enough water high in the mountains, that sometimes claimed that it was part of a top-down water management system for a small part of that region, feeding farms and towns all over the area with this constant supply of fresh water that was stored there. The large central pyramid, Acapana, is the hub of the water management system. It's covered in canals for the water to be directed, and the area underneath, the ground the pyramid itself is made of and sits on, it's a huge reservoir for fresh water. Now, the style of art is different here as well. As Hancock mentions, the statue of Viracocha has a lot of water symbolism. Now, and he's correct. He also highlights that it's similar to a lot of these statues that you see in Assyria and stuff of these fish people. And yes, but it's like symbolism only. I mean, come on, this guy looks like the Little Mermaid's dad. This thing looks like something out of a freaking Lovecraftian nightmare. Now, the issue of dating Tiwanaku via archaeoastronomy is worth looking into. Hancock mentions Poskonosky again, this time claiming the archaeoastronomy of the site makes it to about 17,000 years old. He's basing that off of alignments to the sun. Now, other archaeoastronomers have looked at the site and found different stars and have found dates that match much more better with the mainstream dating of the site, around 2,000 years old. That's one issue with archaeoastronomy that many aren't aware of. There's about a 20% chance of any structure will have an alignment to one of the major things in the sky, the sun, moon, Venus, or one of the most brightest stars. So the chance of some alignment on its own isn't that big of a deal. You really need to start stacking these up, much like the correlations with ancient Egypt I mentioned earlier. You really need to make a pile of these before you can hang your hat on a date. And this isn't what was done here. Now, it is unquestionable that Tiwanaku had different methods behind its construction than other sites. That's readily apparent, like I said. That no other site used these metal cramps. On South America, the clamps are frequently called, but they're called Masonic cramps, and no other site uses them in South America that I'm aware of, and the way that they're used here are far more of a safety feature than an actual, like, bonding thing like they're used in the rest of the world usually. So it's a little bit enigmatic here. Whenever I see these things used as kind of a seat belt as opposed to a nail, I kind of start to look at it and go, that just looks like standard operating procedure, not like something that was troubleshot on the site. So it doesn't really show like a lot of, there's nowhere in the area to see them perfecting this technology. It just starts showing up being used as a seatbelt, like I say, as opposed to a nail. Now, as far as the water goes, like I said, it's very advanced use of it compared to other cities and regions in the area. So once again, it does seem a little bit on the enigmatic side. So as far as places that bear the fingerprints of a lost civilization, you're not going to find spaceships here, but this is a pretty good candidate for a place that did things a lot different than anybody else in the region. Hancock takes us to the Gateway of the Sun with its impressive Viracocha front and center. As Graham discusses the frieze, he moves from the calendar and starts talking about the possibility of it depicting long extinct animals. And this, I have to say, is where he gets way out into the weeds. He's using negative space to find elephants, which I don't know about all that. And if this thing here is Toxodon, and my kids must have seen him too, because they drew that crap all the time when they were growing up. Like I said in my last video on fingerprints, grabbing low-quality evidence only hurts your case, in my opinion. And this is low-quality as I can see. This is the kind of thing that when somebody attacks this section of Fingerprints of the Gods, they'll point out and say, look, you found elephants where there were no elephants. Derpity, derpity, der. So, in my opinion, Mr. Hancock, if you do happen to watch this, in my opinion, in the future, I would whittle that stuff down. I know it'll make for less pages, but there'll be better pages. And finally, we get to the kicker. Tiwanaku was destroyed in a flood, according to Hancock. Now, this is a bit difficult to explain, given what we know, as there are no signs of it being flooded for a very long time, and the rise of the plateau is pretty well established. But he does mention the indigenous people had. There was puzzling evidence from all over the Altiplano that agriculture experiments of an advanced and scientific nature had been carried out with great ingenuity and dedication to try to compensate for the deterioration of the climate. For example, recent research has demonstrated that astonishingly sophisticated analysis of the chemical compositions of many poisonous high-altitude plants and tubers have been undertaken by somebody in this region in the furthest antiquity. Such analysis, furthermore, had been coupled with the invention of detoxification techniques, which had rendered those otherwise nutritious vegetables harmless and edible. There was as yet no satisfactory explanation for the development of these detoxification processes, admitted David Roman, associate professor of anthropology at Washington University. But he seems to have misunderstood it or misrepresented it from the paper itself. Routine identification, however, fails to make clear one very interesting aspect of this assemblage. Plant domestication in the Altiplano required the simultaneous development of detoxification techniques. The majority of the plants listed above contain significant levels of toxins in an untreated state. For example, the potato species that are most resistant to frost and that grow best at high altitudes also contain high levels of glycosylcholine. In addition, the potato contains an inhibitor for a wide range of digestive enzymes necessary for breaking down proteins, a particularly unfortunate trait at high altitudes where the differential partial oxygen pressure already impairs the chemistry of protein breakdown. Potatoes also belong to a group of plants that are nitrate accumulators, and thus potential nutritional difficulties common to such plants as well. Altiplano fathers for several thousand years produced the freeze-dried potato, or chunu, by a process of freezing, leaching, and sun-drying. The initial explanation for this process was that it produced a food product that could be stored for long periods of time. The fact that chunu can be stored for 6 years or more made it possible to reserve surpluses from bumper years and have a secure, year-round food base, permitting farmers to become involved in non-substance activities such as religion, science, philosophy, and politics. We can now suggest another rationale. Leaching and sun-drying are necessary to remove the majority of the solanine and to lower excessive nitrate levels, and the subsequent cooking of these freeze-dried products destroys the inhibitors of digestive enzymes. Rather than arguing that freeze-drying was motivated only by a desire to produce a more secure food base, allowing a more elaborate socio-cultural development, one could hold that this technology was mandatory to make the potato available both as a usable nutritive source. Both factors are clearly present. The other plants identified as early domesticates at Lake Titicaca sites have similar levels of toxins and all require the use of various detoxification techniques to make them suitable for human consumption. Oca has significant amounts of oxalates. Quinoa and Kahnua have high levels of hydroquinic acid and the alkaloid saponin. Amaranth is a nitrate accumulator and has high levels of oxalates. Tarwi contains a poisonous alkaloid lupinin. Beans contain varying levels of cyanogenic leucoid and so on. And so on, I guess. In some instances, the detoxifying procedures serendipitously result in an end product that has excellent storage features, multiplying the beneficial effects of the technology. Where the detoxification technology does not have this added effect, for example, in the case of quinoa, amaranth, and tarwi, the plants generally already have excellent natural storage characteristics. There is, as of yet, no satisfactory explanation for the development of detoxification processes. Why the early inhabitants of the Titicaca Basin continue to experiment with plants that must have given ample gastrointestinal distress during unsuccessful tests until they achieved a practical technology is a question we must still seek to answer.
So it's enigmatic, but it's not the product of a sophisticated chemical analysis. It's the product of painful trial and error. A lot of hurt tummies. But when he talks about the artificial language part, that is mind-blowing. In the 1980s, Ivan Guzman de Rojas did indeed create a multi-language computer translator that's based on the syntax of the Aymara language, using it as a bridge between it and other languages. And up until Google Translate, it was like one of the best translation programs around still. And that's kind of creepy, to be honest. But I mean, seriously, it's the kind of enigma that keeps me coming back to this kind of stuff. It's going through the data. Some of those things fall apart. But things like this, I mean, holy crap. This language is so structured and so computerish that it functions as a bridge between every other language known to man. That's mind-blowing. And no, I'm not saying that we had computers way back when. I'm saying that this language is enigmatic. It shows an understanding that is very out of place for its time. Anyway, that's the end of part two. Thank you very much for watching this far. Check out part one if you haven't and are so inclined to do so. Stick with me for next three. Click for the next part, which will be part three. Click buttons down below. I gotta say, this is fun. It's great going back through all this and like picking apart each little thing and looking into it, because again, things like the language, things like the water, the candelabra being the signpost out to sea, these things they're just effing cool, man. That makes this a whole lot of fun. Anyway, thanks for watching. You guys have a great night.